You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 25th of June 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, John Kerry and Javad Zarif are packing for Vienna to take part in what is supposed to be the final episode of the high-stakes game of deal or no deal that Iran has been playing with the world over its nuclear program. My guests Oscar Guardiola Rivera and Michael Binion will discuss that and the day's other big stories, including what are you having a crisis meeting about? What have you got? EU leaders are gathering in Brussels to discuss Greece's finance, the migrant influx, the UK's restlessness, and in all likelihood, all things considered, the possibility of taking up another line of work. We'll also ask what the correct response should be when a tyrant says he's sorry for all that tyrannizing he did, and we'll look at Thailand's attempts to train journalists to be polite to politicians and wonder how that could possibly go wrong. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the programme. My guests today are Oscar Guardiola Rivera, Senior Lecturer in Law at Birkbeck University of London and the author of What If Latin America Ruled the World, and Michael Binion, Foreign Affairs Specialist for The Times. Welcome both back to the show. Now, first of all, as things currently stand, Iran's Foreign Minister Javad Zarif and US Secretary of State John Kerry are due to fly to Vienna tomorrow to attend what are supposed to be the final lengths of negotiation before a deal on Iran's nuclear programme is agreed on June 30th. Iran has continued to shore up its bluff in recent days. Its parliament has refused UN inspectors access to military sites, and Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei has insisted that sanctions must be lifted before Iran turns the reactors down. Michael, first of all, a possibly stupid question. Is there any chance whatsoever of a deal being signed next Tuesday?
Well, it's like saying, will the Greeks manage it?
we'll get to that in due course.
Yes, possibly, last-minute deal, but it is looking more and more sticky, and the opposition is growing in America to any further concessions. And the Iranians are master carpet bargainers. They know how to bargain to the last final minute.
They are playing some hard ball here, Oscar. Khamenei's also said this week that he's accused the US, rather, of wanting to destroy Iran's nuclear industry. It makes a certain amount of sense for Iran to be sort of upping the tension before a deal is done, but doesn't that sort of talk make it harder for them to actually come to terms? Will they be seen to be capitulating?
They need the agreement as much as the current American administration. It is likely that this stage, both parties up the ante and pretend to be playing hardball. I would say I'm optimistic about the signing of a deal. Maybe not, this date, but it will be signed very soon, certainly before Obama is out of the office.
Michael, there has been some suggestion that the US in particular is not playing hard enough ball, and that's not just from the usual suspects on the Republican side of the House. We've had five former Iran advisors to President Obama have signed an open letter expressing concern that a bad deal from America's and the world's point of view is imminent. Are they right to be worried? Is Obama the kind of president who would think, you know what, a deal will do? A bad deal's better than no deal.
Well, that's been the big argument within the administration. Nobody thinks they're going to get a really good deal. It doesn't look as though we're going to get a complete cessation of all Iranian nuclear activity. And the question is a bad deal or a not very good deal worse than no deal at all? And that's been the debate, which has become almost a public debate. If they don't, if they make the conditions too difficult for Iran and simply walk away, what happens in Iran? They simply go back to a full-blown nuclear program, and then there's no control at all over it.
So, and then presumably the rest of the world ends up at war with Iran.
Yes, possibly, and certainly Israel would not feel constrained any further about not attacking Iran. And the debate has been, should the Obama administration play hardball to the very last minute, or should it make it clear that it is willing to do a deal, although it wants better conditions? And these five people who've signed the letter, they are all pretty senior, and they have a lot of influence, and they have been close to the negotiations. So there clearly is some concern that the Obama administration is perhaps not being tough enough at this stage.
The thread I found difficult to follow here, and I'll put this question to both of you, starting with you, Oscar, is, are we clear, certainly from the outside view, hopefully the negotiators are clear, are we clear on what Iran actually does seriously want? Because there still seems to be a certain amount of doubt, and it may be constructive doubt from Iran's point of view, about whether they want to be a nuclear-armed state. And surely the people who run Iran, whatever you may think of them, they're not stupid. They can see what a potential disaster a nuclear arms race in the Middle East would be. Do they actually want that, or do they want to just be able to climb down from the position they've got themselves into with a measure of dignity?
The latter, certainly the latter. They know that they will not be allowed to pursue a nuclear arms race. And they also know that it's of not benefit for anyone in the region. Certainly the Americans are not stupid. Of course, maybe it won't be the deal, the perfect deal that some of us would prefer. But it would be a deal that makes sure that Iran does not simply continue doing what it has been doing.
Is that an assumption that we can make, Michael, that Iran actually doesn't really want to have nuclear weapons?
I'm not so sure about that. I think they rather would like, in their heart of hearts, to have a bomb, because they feel that with a bomb, then they can't be pushed around. And Iran is a country that does put a huge amount of store by its dignity, its place in the world, its historic tradition, its ancient civilization, all that. They feel that they are a voice that has a right to be heard. And they look at those other nuclear-armed powers and say, well, they can have much more say in their region than they would have if they hadn't had a bomb. And they do think that it would actually enhance their prestige and their standing and all that. I agree, however, with Oscar, that I think at the moment they really do need a deal. The question is, at what price? Now, it doesn't look as though that any deal at the moment will rule out a nuclear bomb forever. What it will probably do is make it very, very difficult for the next 10 to 15 years, by which time, of course, things may have changed inside Iran.
Well, no deal can, of course, ban such things forever. I mean, as much as we would like to, things might change, circumstances will change. The Middle East is in a state of flux. Certainly, Iran has other means of influence. We see what is happening in Yemen. So, the nuclear strategy is not the only one.
Well, on the cheerful subject, before we move on, of thermonuclear apocalypse, NATO has this week announced it's reviewing its nuclear weapons policy, specifically vis-a-vis Russia. Michael, NATO saying they're reviewing their nuclear weapons policy, does this actually mean anything, or is this the sort of thing you say just to remind the other side that, we've got these?
Well, it's hard to tell. I mean, nearly all this posturing over nuclear weapons is exactly that, is posturing. Neither side is actually contemplating launching nuclear missiles at the other side, and certainly not at this stage of the level of tensions. The Russians and the Americans have from various times made big announcements saying they're no longer targeting the other side's cities. Well, you sort of think, well, if they're not targeting them, what are they doing with the weapons? They're just sitting there. It only takes a few moments to reprogram a target on a nuclear warhead. So these various statements about being ready or readying their weapons or getting them into a state of enhanced preparedness, they don't really mean very much. They're intended to send a signal, and a signal of displeasure.
I mean, Oscar, at the risk of getting into a whole sort of weird area of game theory here, doesn't this rather illustrate the difficulty with the idea of a nuclear deterrent, that it actually really only works if the other side is at least a little bit worried you're the kind of people who would actually use it? Because the example that always strikes me is that Argentina's invasion of the Falklands in 1982 at that level looks preposterous. You have a basically third world banana republic seizing the territory of a nuclear armed superpower. But Argentina was able to make the assumption that there was no way at all, none, that Britain would even mention its nuclear weapons in the context of the Falklands, as indeed Britain didn't. Do you basically need your potential enemies to assume that you're actually quite mad for the deterrent to work?
Let me first say that I completely disagree with your banana republic attribution.
But, in 1982.
Okay, we'll talk about that later. But certainly, as we heard before, we all know that the nuclear deterrence is an insane policy, but it works at some sort of rhetorical level in which both people say mine is bigger than yours. And of course, I'm referencing some things here, perhaps a cartoon in The Simpsons. But again, as we heard before, this idea that there is a reaction because Russia said they would buy 40 more missiles. Okay, you have 2,000 and something. What is the difference? 40 more, 40 less does make a difference.
They can bomb 40 cities again.
Exactly, but this idea that at some point they will bomb each other, well, we all know that that's, if that ever happens, we're all doomed and that's it. So, again, the posturing is there to send a signal. And this diplomacy, nuclear diplomacy, has always worked in that sense.
I mean, it really takes two to blackmail, that's the thing.
Yeah, that's the thing.
You've got to be blackmailable.
Okay, well, we will move on from that because it is a bit of a crisis summit fest in Europe this week. EU leaders are meeting in Brussels today and tomorrow to share their despair at Intrays overflowing with such crises as Greece's ongoing efforts to keep the bailiffs on the other side of the door, the unceasing waves of migrants floating across the Mediterranean and or climbing aboard strike-bound lorries near Calais, and the question, focused rather by the aforementioned, of how much longer the UK will favour staying part of this club. Now, I reckon we've got 8 or 9 minutes before the break, so let's see if we can sort all this out. Michael, Greece, first of all, if now is not the time to admit that Greece shouldn't have joined the euro in the first place, when is that time?
Well, it's hard to find any time frame that really works with anything going on in Greece at the moment. Yes, now is not the time they should have joined. Now, I think, is the time, frankly, they should leave. And I think a lot of Europeans think that too. And I think the posturing we've seen in the last day or two just shows that there is such a reluctance and such bad blood that although I've talked about this on this programme perhaps for the last 4 months, and every time I've been pessimistic, and every time the others have said, Europe will buy them out, we'll pay for it, I still am fairly pessimistic. I just think there isn't the spirit there to make the necessary concessions at the last minute.
Oscar, where the EU is concerned, then, is it time to prise Greece's fingernails from the doorframe and send them on their way?
Look, part of the problem with this is that it's not just Greece. The Europeans and the Troika behind and everybody who's imposing on Greece this insanity of economic blackmail, they're actually sending also a message to Spanish voters. And this is, we hear all the, economic arguments. Some of them are good, most of them are terrible, at least according to people like Krugman and Stiglitz, and they have Nobel Prizes, so maybe they know better that. But the politics
of
this...
Henry Kissinger and Yasser Arafat have got Nobel Prizes for peace.
Well, you know why you get a Nobel Prize for peace if you make war. But the problem with sending a signal to the Spanish voters is that it might backfire. My question is, what will happen if Podemos wins in November? Now Europe will be dealing with the fourth largest economy. Are they going to do the same, just force them to leave? And then there is the question of Great Britain. Are we just witnessing the breaking apart of the Union? This story will run for a very long time.
I think there's equally a dangerous signal to be sent the other way. In other words, if at the last minute they say, all right, we'll pay this extra money, you don't have to go through these austerity measures, then everybody in Spain will say, well, why did we even bother to start?
I agree with you, if only because what Greece needs is, yes, some debt relief, but also a growth strategy. And that's, those two elements are not under discussion right now. So whatever is done right now is not going to be favorable to Greece or to Europe as a whole. So we will be dealing with this problem in the future.
Okay, well, I think we'll have to call our attempts to sort that one out a partial success. It's not easy, is it? And that's 3 entire minutes we spent on that. Migration, then. It's been a dominant theme of this year, these ghastly scenes of people crowded into barely seaworthy vessels, shunted across the Mediterranean in the hope of a better life on the northern shore of it. And this week, of course, we have seen those bizarre scenes in Calais as migrants sort of use the cover of smoke from burning tyre barricades to climb aboard lorries stuck in traffic jams. The one thing that everybody does agree on, I think that everyone agrees on, that the current situation is just horrific and unlikely to improve of its own accord. Oscar, I'll ask you first, is there actually a realistic option that nobody has suggested yet?
It's very difficult. This is a very difficult question because, of course, the realistic option has to do with the breaking down of Syria, what is happening in Libya, the fact that the borders no longer exist, and you have a failed state in the case of Libya and a lot of people crossing. So there is one strategy that you need to distinguish the humanitarian issue from the more political issue. On the humanitarian issue, Europe will have to deal with the amount of people that are crossing, and we will have to do so in the most humanitarian manner. Also, there needs to be a common policy. That's part of the problem right now. Only Greece and Italy are dealing with this. And of course, it will be difficult to see the UK, for instance, accepting a share of these migrants, anytime soon, because that will put the current government in a difficulty with its electorate. So I don't see a prompt solution to this.
Michael, Oscar has hit upon what I think is the key problem there, and it's an under-discussed one, I think, because it is somewhat shameful, which is that the reality is that there is very little sympathy for these people among European electorates. I think there's sympathy in the abstract that everybody's terribly sorry for the situation these people are in, but really there's very little, I guess, active sympathy as in where they're welcome here. I think that attitude is lacking in European electorates and certainly in the European media. I just end up wondering, possibly rather bleakly, does this mean the EU now has a choice between possibly taking a harder line now and leaving open the possibility that if this goes on for months or years, that European politics gradually gets subsumed by populist centre-more back right-wingers?
Well, possibly. I think, in a way, the anger about these people is tempered by the interviews with some of them, because some of them have appeared, first of all, very articulate. Some of them are university graduates. Some of them speak very good English.
Well, quite a few of them.
They would be well qualified. And you
probably
have to think...
all of them.
Yeah, exactly. And in terms of absolute numbers, although you see, 40,000 or 100,000 who've actually made it to the mainland, spread among 20-something countries or more, that's not that many per country. I mean, the number of people who come legally every year to live in Britain is far, far greater than that.
All of which is entirely true, but that would be career suicide for any political leader to stand up and
problem.
Say,
that's the danger, exactly. And I mean, on the other hand, I mean, Britain has done this before. They did take in 40,000 Ugandan Asians, and they came, but of course it was slightly different. They were already British passport holders, and that was an exception. And even then, that wasn't very popular about 45 years ago. But how to deal with these people now, it's just not realistic to think they can be sent back.
Isn't that also lack of leadership on the part of our politicians? I mean, sometimes if we are wrong, if we, the public, are wrong, we need our leaders to tell us so. But they do not dare to tell us that
the
we need to change our attitude.
It can't be an open door. It can't be, yes, we'll take them in, and we'll take in those who come next year, and the year after that, and the year after that. It's like an amnesty for illegal migrants in the US. This is a sort of one-time thing. You have an amnesty. Mind you, they've had about several.
Well, exactly.
I mean, you have a one-time amnesty, and then you actually build a wall stopping people coming across from Mexico or wherever. And I'm afraid they've got to do something. They've got to have a metaphorical wall reinforcing the southern boundaries of Europe. There's no other way.
But look at what happened. I mean, you mentioned the United States. By 2040, Latinos will be a majority, and the entire country will be a minority-majority country. So there may be an example there to follow.
Well, finally then, on this subject of UK crisis summits, we have the UK, and I guess we are led neatly into that discussion by what we've just been discussing. Oscar, I'll ask you first, if and when this referendum occurs in the UK, and it will occur as long as this government stays in government, because they promised that it would, to what extent do you think it's actually really basically going to be a referendum on immigration?
Well, probably to a great extent. That's certainly the case, which is why this was so dangerous. I mean, this is a dangerous bid. We do not know what the circumstances will be like come the time of the referendum. And we have a massive migration crisis. And, you already see the beginnings of it there. Then the current government might actually lose control of the discussion.
And final thought from you on this, Michael. At the moment, polls still show in the UK that most British people favour staying in, although interestingly the outvote has actually rather spiked in recent weeks. How confident would you be to predict the result now?
I'd be pretty confident in the long run, given another 2 years or year and a half at least of campaigning, that when you start bringing in the heavy guns, particularly the economic guns, showing what Britain's actual economic interests are, and the fact that Cameron himself and other senior ministers are going to be campaigning for a yes vote, I'm pretty confident in the long run that there will be a yes. But on the other hand, I do think they need to do at least something to pretend that they've got control of this migration question. And the one thing they could do, bar the ban on free movement, which they're not going to ban, what they could do is change the benefit system for people who come from other countries so they can't claim benefits soon after coming to this country.
Oh, they'll do that. And let's hope they do not bring the HSBC Bank as one of those big banks.
We will take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Oscar Guardiola Rivera and Michael Binion. Coming up next, what do you do with an apologetic tyrant? And who in the wide world of sports is advising Thailand's Prime Minister on media relations?
The brand new M24 iPhone app brings you the full radio offering from Monocle 24. Listen live to our four daily news programmes or catch the freshest tunes on our playlist. And of course, there's the Time Shift, where you can delve into our show archive and listen at your leisure. All our great magazine programmes covering everything from international affairs to culture, design to urbanism, food and drink to entrepreneurship. It's all available anytime on the new, free Monocle 24 iPhone app. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me, Oscar Guardiola Rivera from Birkbeck University and Michael Binion from The Times. Now, the first response to seeing the name of Manuel Noriega in the headlines might be bemusement that he's still alive. But it turns out that the former Panamanian tyrant is not only still above ground, if confined to an extremely small patch of it, but apologetic. In his first TV interview from nearly two decades from his prison cell in Panama City, the 81-year-old ex-despot has said sorry to those, as he put it, offended, affected, injured, or humiliated by his rule, and asked for his forgiveness. Oscar, is there any reason that anyone in Panama or anywhere else, in fact, should really care what Noriega thinks about anything at this stage?
Look, in general, I'm fed up with this apology syndrome. What is going on? You know, you kill people, you're, I'm sorry, and then you're supposed to be forgiven. Now, there is nothing to forgive him for here. He should not be forgiven. He was on the payroll of the CIA until seven months before being overthrown by the very same government that was paying him. So, and he, all the while, he was channeling drug money to buy weapons for the Salvadorian Contra. Now, the guy, you know, if he issued an apology, nobody should care. I'm pretty sure that in Panama, not many people care, and we shouldn't listen. Mind you, the problem here, again, is the historic, you know, the historical importance and the ambiguity of these characters. They were, again, in the payroll of the Americans at the same time they were, you know, playing against them.
Well, Noriega was, of course, an updated version of what FDR is reported to have said of Somoza, that he may be a son of a bitch, but he's our son of a bitch, which he was up until, of course, the point that he wasn't. Michael, as Oscar has just reminded everybody, Noriega was about as comprehensively as dreadful a man as has run a country in modern times. Is he forgivable?
Well, in the scale of brutality and in the scale of dictators in the world, he's not the worst.
that's not much right. Of a campaign slogan, is it?
I mean, 20 years is quite a long time to serve in prison for your misdeeds. I mean, a lot of other dictators murder far many more people and then live scot-free. Idi Amin, you know, goes to Saudi Arabia and lives his life in luxury after leaving his country, yeah, Uganda, in chaos.
But it's a high-risk game, though, because a lot of dictators don't even get to end up spending retirement
in
jail.
Well, you get knocked off before then. That's
indeed
certainly true.
Where will Noriega go?
I mean, he can stay where he is. And I think a lot of people stay
in that prison cell. Yeah, I agree with you.
I'm not too worried about whether he comes out. I mean, I think he has served time, but I don't think he murdered as many others have.
Not really that much of a defence, I don't think. He did call himself, Oscar, the last general of the military era, I think referring to the Latin American period of rule by strongmen, to which I tactlessly alluded earlier describing Argentina in the 80s. Has Latin America and South America entirely moved past that now? Are we free of the spectre of men with gold braids on their caps running countries?
Well, perhaps they do not wear green fatigues these days, at least not most of them, but men in suits and ties can be as authoritarian. And of course, there are, big questions being asked in the region. In the case of Mexico, for instance, others ask those questions in the case of Venezuela. One might agree or not with what is going on in either of these two countries. I would not call them a dictatorship. I think that is completely useless. Is, you know, those comparisons.
President Maduro in Venezuela, of course,
not a dictator.
Hasn't called for an election,
exactly.
Which on current polls,
exactly,
he will lose.
Exactly. So, if that is the case, and I want to emphasize the fact that Latin America does seem to have turned the page on that era.
Well, let us hope so. And finally tonight, however, I've been looking forward to this one. Thailand's Prime Minister Prayuth Chan-o-cha has generally failed to charm the press since seizing power last year. Early in his term, the former general whimsically mused that given the choice, he would probably just execute hacks who displeased him. Possibly as a consequence, Chan-o-cha's junta has summoned 200 reporters, local and foreign, to a meeting where they will be taught how to ask questions that don't upset him. Michael, aside from, you know, having a story to tell afterwards, why would any reporter show up at this?
Well, I think just out of amusement, yes, indeed bemusement, that a man could be so crass and so extraordinary that he just really doesn't know how the press works at all, and think that you can just, you know, tell people.
I want to see the syllabus.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. What would be the course? How to write nice
man,
things?
I hope there's an English translation of the handout. That will be glorious.
Yes,
it is amazing. It's one of those ideas you can just about imagine somebody having. But I think it's interesting that it illustrates that, as is often the case, I think with your strongmen, they tend not to have people in their entourage willing to put their hand up and go, oh, for the love of God, that's a terrible idea, don't do it. Is this just a tyrant's hubris we're looking at here?
I don't know. Somebody should show up and just ask, would you promise to execute me if I promise to tell the truth?
And it is also, but it has that weird, vaguely Stalinist tone to it as well. And again, it strikes me as an initiative by somebody who doesn't understand the times we're living in. I mean, Michael, in the current day and age of the media landscape being what it is, short of actually turning your country into North Korea, is it possible still to enforce this kind of loyalty?
Well, it's possible to clamp down on the press in quite an insidious and unpleasant way, and you only have to look at Russia to see how that's being carried out. You don't do anything by sudden kind of closing of papers or shutting down a radio station. You may do one or two of those to set an example, but you gradually make it very, very uncomfortable for journalists to operate freely and openly, to the point where they self-censor, and then they become essentially tools of the state. And what I like about the Thai example is he's so wonderfully naive. He just says what a great many rulers actually think. I mean, they say nasty things. Why do they do it? Why can't I control them?
You're absolutely right. I mean, freedom of the press is in danger pretty much everywhere. I mean, here in the UK, we have the example of what happened with The Guardian and the Snowden files. My only hope here is that Seth Rogen and James Franco will have material for a sequel.
But on that subject, Oscar, Michael mentioned the way that self-censorship can become really insidious if you create that climate in which people think there's certain questions they shouldn't ask. Is it possible that Prayuth Chan-o-cha or someone close to him is actually some kind of bizarre genius in terms of handling the press?
I don't know. Maybe it looks like a throw to the past, but maybe they're an evil nightmare coming to us from the future. There is indeed a lot of self-censorship out there. There are plenty of journalists ready to ask the right questions to please their private owners or what they think the public want. I remember Carl Bernstein telling us during a Hay Festival not long ago that he was very concerned about the fact that the public were asking for confirmation of what they believed rather than a tool for self-criticism. So we must stand for self-criticism, certainly not on the side of the Prime Minister of Thailand.
We will have to leave it there, unfortunately. Gentlemen, Oscar Guardiola-Rivera and Michael Binion, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House. That is all we have time for today. The show was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Tamor Haveda-Williams. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. For the next half hour, Chris Lord in Istanbul will be keeping you company with our international playlist. At 1900 hours, it's The Urbanist with Andrew Tuck. At 2200 hours tonight, The Monocle Daily is here with Emma Nelson and Peter Osborne. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow at 1800 London time. I'll be your host again for that. But for this edition, it's goodbye and thanks for listening.